subject and how individuals who are in, or the group that's in a position of privilege and authority and power aren't identified when individuals who aren't in that position tend to be identified as the female or the black or...
The fine working class poet or something, and we don't always go around talking about, you know, the fine privileged poet that so-and-so might have been. But yeah, this is an important aspect of language, that we somehow assume that we know we're talking about a person in a privileged position when we don't specify. And then we specify people who are in more marginalized positions. And that has an implication for how it seems we're valuing those different categories. Yeah.
I think one of the last things that we were talking about is the fact of the whiteness is the minority in the world, and it soon will be the minority in the United States. And what, how fear is driving some of the reactions that have already happened, and what the future will bring and what our role in that future will be.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that was one of the things that came sort of at the end that perhaps will be quite big in the future.
Yeah. And this kind of brings us to this question of what do we do to strengthen our wheatiness in the language of Sunday's sermon. I think most of us were at Sunday's sermon, and we're sort of distinguishing between this problem of wheat and chaff growing up together, and whose job is it anyway to weed that garden or weed the field, and the idea that the biblical mandate is that it is not our job to weed amongst ourselves, but to allow the judgment to be made later on, because we might know, not recognize, we might uproot the wrong things, we might be thinking we're uprooting the right things and sort of damage ourselves in the process.
I was just thinking there's another interpretation of that parable, too.
There are always many.
For instance, say, look, he was preaching to farmers, and they know very well if you don't weed, you don't get anything. Everything gets crowded out.
Mm-hmm.
So that there was a bit of humor in Jesus pointing out that, boy, this ain't the way it, you know, if you don't weed your field, you'll lose everything.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Well, it's what I'm always interested in any biblical story is that that there are multiple ways they can be taken or shaped or understood, and how we understand them has a lot to do with our own values and our own experiences and how we relate to them. So I was thinking in listening to that passage and listening to the sermon that occurred that in relation to the task I was asked to do this week, I thought, well, that's a really good one, because I think it is important for us to not just identify and recognize those categories of other, but do some work recognizing the specificity of the positions of power, and I really do think that it's through telling individual stories and sort of acknowledging the ways in which even those of us within one alleged category, you know, we might think we have a ton in common with one another, but we might not, based on just what we look like. And if we share, instead of abdicating our own ethnic background for the sake of a big broad box and category, I think we'll get further with ourselves and a sense of integrity about ourselves, and we'll be able to foster relationships with one another with greater integrity if we really do ground ourselves in all of the different categories, the ways in which we're privileged and some of the ways in which we're not, and to really sort of have a clear insight, a clear sense of self to bring into the world. And I think the clearer sense of self we have in as honest a way as we can have it, and I think it's this unmarked subject that sometimes causes us to not be able to be as honest as we maybe should be, because we just aren't noticing some stuff about how our lives are benefited by certain aspects of ourselves that we don't have to think about, and people who are not benefited by that same characteristic have to think about all the time. Yes, please.
Yeah, I just want to make an observation, and I'm originally from India, but I was born in a Christian family. So when we migrated to the United States and we came to Chicago, it was very easy for us to get integrated because we can go to church, everybody welcomed you, became part of the community. For us, it was not that big a challenge as it would have been for a Hindu or a Muslim from India. So by being a Christian already, I was in a privileged group, it seems like.
Yeah, you do share some things in a the context of America. There's some cachet to Christianity, certainly. And so, yeah, that's a great detail that can cause any of us, I think, to go, okay, wait a minute, what do I have that maybe someone else doesn't? And if I can be aware of those things, I can be more open, more sensitive. And I think the other curious thing that it enables us to do when we are clear about our own identity is that it enables us to move forward without a sense of guilt or shame that I think it's possible to do if, you know, for example, here we are in the year 2011, and we are all of us at the moment in a country with this history of slavery and racism against a lot of different groups of people, the people from China who built the railroads and then were marginalized. You know, we've done a lot of othering of people who are not white in this geography. And I know for myself, you know, there are ways in which I can carry around a sense of guilt and shame and sorrow over the kind of history that, in a way, my people have perpetuated, even if I hope that I have not acted in profoundly negative ways. I think to the extent that awareness and maybe a sense of healthy shame or sorrow can help us move forward or have greater awareness, that's good. But I think any of us can understand that beating ourselves up is not helping our wheathood grow either. You know, we don't need to, like, hack ourselves down. That's really not what the task is either. That's not going to help us connect or foster relationships with a richly diverse community. So my thought for today, I have a couple different poems to read to us today, and then I'm hoping that we will all do a little bit of possibly some writing, if you've got something to write with, or possibly a little storytelling with one another about our own identity. I called this Beyond the Boxes, I guess, and this was kind of a simple, you know, we were asked to name all of our sessions. Okay. But, you know, I think most of us are aware when we have to fill out forms for taxes or for, you know, any legal purpose, there are those boxes and we've got like six options, right? We're Caucasian, we are Hispanic or Latino, we are Native American / other somehow, there's African American, So globally, the 7+ billion of us have to cram ourselves into six possibilities. And most of us probably do belong in the other somehow. And again, that's sort of a symbol of how ridiculous it is to think that we have things in common with this giant mass of people who all might check the same box. So sometimes in classes of mine where we are reading literature by non-white writers, I do this activity where I have us go around and just identify our heritage without using the words black, white, Asian, Native American, in order to get ourselves to be more ethnically specific. I'm half Norwegian, and I'm a quarter German and a quarter English, And those are all quite different. And they, the, you know, who was which in my family tree has been important. And you know, so the any of us can do this work to get a little more specific. I'm from this tribe. I'm from this region. I'm from this set of things. So this is the kind of work I hope we can do in the course of an hour. But I should stop the intros again and share a little literature because I think that's fun. So I'm going to read just a few poems, first of all. And I'm going to start because I'm a white European person with...
You said white.
I did. In order to say, I'm, we're not in the exercise yet. Those who make the rules can also break. these are all different in type, but I thought this poem was a good example of someone who is doing the work for herself, of breaking down, I am a white person, but what really does this mean for me as an individual? This was a spoken word poem. I'm not very good as a spoken word artist, but I'll read it. There was a diversity symposium at the College of San Mateo, California in the spring of 2008, and this was the first performer to get on the floor. And a number of people in the audience were a little wary. There's this interesting conversation afterward about whether at a diversity symposium a white person should be up front reading a poem about whiteness. Because again, there's that sort of fallacy that diversity means the other ones, right? that white people are just white people, and then the diverse people somehow are those who are something else. But the crowd loved this poem. There was a really positive response, and I thought it would be very in keeping with sort of the spirit of today. So it's called My People, White People. And it resonated with me a bit, and it might resonate with some of you. And again, I think the purpose of naming specificity enables anyone, even who doesn't share this background, to feel a connection, because we all have a very specific kind of background. In the teaching of creative writing, it's kind of there's an interesting rule that if you're wanting to connect with as broad an audience as possible, you need not to make the error of trying to create a universal character. Because when you intend to create a universal character, it gets so bland that it's nobody at all. You know, it's this sort of abstraction of humanity. And that, in fact, this you will connect with the broadest audience possible as a writer if you make as specific and personal a story as you can. Because everyone has a sense of, the pains I carry for these specific reasons. And if someone can write their story to me in a way that helps me get, that's their really specific source of pain, it connects with mine, even if the details are different. Is that, I see some nodding. And it seems counterintuitive in a way, and it's certainly an error that young writers, college, traditional undergrad age writers are often doing this. You know, they're wanting everyone to like their work, so they make these bland, cliched characters that everyone reads and is just like, I can't care about that person because nobody is that person, you know. So again, that's sort of a reminder of the power of specificity in terms of making connection across difference. My People, White People. I suppose I should at least stand up because this was a performance that somebody had memorized. It's much more powerful to hear the original author do it, but my people, white people. Truth be told, we never were a people. Fragments of cultures that bought into privilege called whiteness. The invisible word. I remember 10th grade family history project being more concerned about my place in the human race. Bypassed cultural legacy for oneness. "We are all one," my white people said. Not a color thing, just people. My people, white people, land of independent nuclear families, smothering ideals of perfection, bottled up resentments, blistering silences, no such thing as mistakes or getting messy. We keep quiet to our own addictions, then blame people of color for all things called bad. Poverty, drug abuse, domestic violence, molestation, perceived as isolated problems that white people are free from. My people, white people, we say we are not racist, yet we are raised in a racist society. Pass on stereotypes of what we think people of color are really like to our children. We are fed half-truths and lies in history books. We sit silently while children are made into puppets on TV color. White children learn diversity through Disney's Pocahontas and Aladdin. Stereotypes that my grandparents taught me filtered my own perceptions. My people, we have been hurt to think this separation does not chain our minds and hurt our souls. As I mind my mind with forgiveness, I let go of shame for my own people I've deemed myself better than. I've acted out the lies I've been told, believing I was never racist. I sat in silence. Guilt immobilized my mind, held my own spirit captive. Ego chatter categorized good white people and bad white people. Heaven on earth looks like oneness with my own people. What is the use of pretending I am not like those white people who latch on to other cultures in order to cope with fragmented family histories? My people, from Irish, Scottish, English, German, and unknown descent, carried legacies of hurt with them, pulled up from bootstraps laced in shoes stained in blood of slavery and genocide. My people, white people, let's love the hurts of forgotten legacies into wholeness. Let's forgive our forefathers and mothers as we forgive ourselves for the violence, silence, shame, and separation that internalized racial superiority has caused, for living in comfortable bubbles of safety, for believing we were never racist. Let's educate ourselves and other white people to histories ignored. Instead of asking people of color to be our teachers or explain the hurts they have faced. My people, white people, I vow to love you, arms wide open, as I love my baby niece. All white people, no matter what you've said, done, kept silent in the name of privilege, you are good people. It's time to mourn the hurts we've afflicted as a people. It's time to grieve our separation from our own indigenous heritages, each cultural legacy dropped in the name of survival. It's time to love our peoples, love ourselves, consciously awaken from our legacy of racial smog into awareness of our white privileges and culture. Let us create pride in our people, birthed in freedom, shared power, prosperity, and tangible oneness with all people. My people, white people, the spiritual revolution is calling you. What's that?
Who's the author?
What is her name? Dana Kaiser Davidson. Comments on that before I read two others that are a bit shorter? What do you think?
That it takes about 20 readings before I get it
off. A good poem will invite you to come back. It's not like reading a newspaper article. You read it, got it. I can wrap fish in it the next day. Yeah, fair enough. responses, subjective, like, dislike, a detail that interests.
One line that really struck me was about needing to grieve the land that our ancestors left in that separation.
Yeah. I think some of my colleagues, I graduated from St. Olaf, land of many Scandinavians and others, and I know a lot of my colleagues, my age folks, who have been having kids that they're all naming Norwegian names again. And there's the, you know, my own Norwegian parents and uncles and aunts have names like David, you know.
Yeah.
And my little friends' kids are all Solveigs and Rittas and Signas and these kinds of things. And I think it does suggest this desire to sort of hook back into something, and it does sort of tap into this broad national history of, I want to be known as Irish or Italian or whatever. Those groups were all bickering and putting each other down in certain ways. Let's just all be American. But there is something lost eventually. And now we're, you know, there are people like, I want to know where I am from. Because I'm not just like every other person here. Yeah.
I think the poem makes me feel a little bit uncomfortable about forgiving our forefathers.
Say more about that.
That makes me feel uncomfortable, as long as we're still in a position of privilege. You know, that I understand the concept of that, but as long as we remain in a position of privilege, that kind of forgiveness for these transgressions.
Yeah.
Makes me uncomfortable.
Yeah. What needs to happen for forgiveness in any context to be offered? What's the right time?
But forgiveness doesn't mean that what they did was okay.
Right.
Yeah.
I think the problem I have with forgiveness, and especially where it's morally dictated, is that that puts me in the position of, I'm assuming I have that power and that right. And I don't think that's true.
Well,
I don't think it is my position to judge, I guess is what I'm saying here. And to some extent, I went to the ecology, and you know, the question was, what's sustainable? And people kept sort of coming back to, well, let's make it the same. Wait a minute, things have to change. I'm a little wary about the judgmental aspect of some of these. I mean, the closest one I think of is a Harvard professor, Divinity School, was charged arguing with a black student. And he saw it and he came back and he said, you know, I've thought this over and I treat blacks the same way as I do whites. The black man looked up and he says, that's the problem.
Well, this is the thing, that if we are colorblind, that is not healthy for any of us. And this is why the naming of individuals, you know, my heritage, which is much more complex than whiteness, and any African-American person has a heritage that is much more specific, and, you know, they're, I forget how many countries, nations that exist right now in Africa, but of course there are many more within any nation, communities and groups, etc. So it's not a question of, you know, if I say, here's my specific background and your specific background, we're no longer going to be treating each other as everyone. We're going to be treating each other in the knowledge of the specific people that we are. But this question of forgiveness, it is a tricky one. And I'm not standing behind, you know, this is the right way to go. This is one person's expression. You know, this is one of the things that I like about literature is that, you know, an individual voice can say, here's where I'm at, here's what I'm thinking about. And then we all get to interact with that in whatever ways we want and, you know, allow it to impact our thinking and cause us to maybe resist, maybe agree, maybe think about how that affects me. But the forgiveness in this particular poem is a self-forgiveness rather than I will forgive y'all for being the idiots y'all have been, you know, how obnoxious is that? But if we think in terms of psychology, I don't know how many of you read like self-help books or, you know, spiritual healing kinds of books. In order to grow and change, there is a certain need to acknowledge error and to do something that's going to help you get beyond it, right? If you just think, I've screwed up, which every single one of us has a million times in our life on lots of issues, but if you get stuck on that, I'm a terrible person, I'm an idiot, you know, my parents were idiots, you know, my grandfather is my favorite person on the planet, sometimes used some derogatory racial terms that, you know, the couple of moments that I heard them rung in my ears, and they came from, he was born in 1906, and if we get hung up on those errors, then we are in a difficult position for a newer way of relating with one another. So that's one thought. I completely agree with you that choosing to be the judge of someone else is difficult. I think the sense of it in the poem I read is trying to sort of, you know, I'm gonna acknowledge, like you say, it doesn't mean it was okay that it happened. You have to articulate what happened before you can apologize or be forgiven. I don't know how many of you have remember those experiences with your little kids, you know, and they smack their sibling or something, and then you say, you have to apologize. And the kid really needs to know what they did before an apology will matter, right? You have to sort of say, now here's what you need to know about slapping people upside the head. And that needs to be a genuine, I'm sorry. And so that the person who's been slapped can say, I forgive you. Because otherwise, you don't want to forgive someone who's not really aware. They're giving lip service to it.
But no, this woman clearly felt bad about those things. So in that sense, she'd already made the judgment for herself.
The judgment was already there.
Yeah. And she needed to try to get on with her life.
Yeah.
Yeah, maybe there's an element of political correctness in my thinking, but I almost wish the poem had been written by a person who wasn't white, white people.
Oh. Well,
forgiving your ancestors and yourselves. And
I have
you know, in a way, it's because it was written by a white person, that's what makes me feel uncomfortable.
Which is interesting.
Not guilt, just this kind of
Can I read you a subsequent poem from the same? There's a blog post that went up after the conference, a whole bunch of people put in. And so the next one that follows is called Dear White Ally. So I wasn't necessarily going to read it, but it seems appropriate. And it's not that this is, you know, this is the one I happen to have. It isn't necessarily going to speak directly to our moment, but. This was written, this was presented at the same conference, but it was written on the anniversary of MLK Jr.'s assassination date. Where's the author? This person. I think this person filed anonymously, so I'm afraid I can't give you an author, but there is one. Dear White Ally, privilege is no longer a bad word, and perfectionism comes with new definitions. Conscious humanity, ever evolving. There are no boxes, charts, theorems, or postulates that will give you the magic key, for fixing hasn't ever truly worked, and we are walking into healing as remedy. Dear White Ally, I need you to know that this letter is mine. As I know my mother's white and freckled skin as my own somewhere inside. Please take note that I am clear we are related, even when you're confused about just how exactly. Dear White Ally, It's purging time right now. We are to sweat out competition and exhale our attachment to capitalism. We are to still our ideas to the possibility of new thoughts. We need to question our identities, and hell, we need to question our realities. We need to speak, dance, sing, paint, express. You see, freedom from silence is your next evolutionary development. You might not stay cozy. Dear white ally, I love you, I see you, and I believe in you now more than ever. Interesting conference, and you know, we all have our own journey to make in terms of our relationships to our past, our relationships to the people with whom we come into contact and such, but one thing that came up near the end of our museum conversation was that a museum is a monolith to something in the past, and we sort of freeze it in time because we might lose it otherwise, because time keeps moving forward. And we are inevitably moving into something different, where every generation is moving into something different, and it's why every generation is panicked. You know, every generation has an expression of fear over change, right? Oh, kids these days, they're nothing like the kids we were. You know, like, what's going on? Technology is so different. You know, they're gonna, nobody's reading books anymore. These are my, you know, anxieties. everyone's attention spans are changing. We know politically, there's a lot of tension right now about who is among us in this country. And who gets to join us? And how about we try to fix it in time, right now? Let's put some walls up that are, you know, physical, but even more insidiously, sort of ideological. You know, let's enough mixing. You know, we really need to defend something. So there's something we need to defend. But again, there's this rigidity that is going to be the thing that sort of sticks in our craw when we're trying to be authentic with others. And I come back to this image of, you know, how do we go about being wheat rather than messing around with the chaff, trying to figure out who's the chaff and what to do. You know, it is sort of claiming ourselves. The only person we can change or heal is ourselves. We cannot grant healing to someone else. We can say things to other people that we may have hurt in any situation, and you know there is a working together that always needs to happen. We don't live in a completely isolated bubble. But I think this is the sort of paradox about how to connect and become a celebratory diverse society rather than sort of doing diversity in a way that keeps the boundaries up and keeps othering groups and keeps those sort of power differentials kind of in play instead of really undermining them. Let's see. I'll read one other poem, and then I want us to work together.
Can I just say one
thing?
Yes,
please.
I really like the way the guy disagreed with her in a loving way.
Mm.
You know, I mean, I wish our politicians would do that more.
Rather than
crucifying the other side.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And this is, you know, in the sermon from Sunday, in the analogy where the person who owns the field that now has good and bad seeds growing or whatever, it's that person in the representation of God saying, it's okay, you know, let everybody grow, you know, and I'll figure it out. And your task is to grow, and if we do a good job of growing, there will be room for the others to grow. And we won't be intervening always with others' growth or naming or finding themselves. Thanks. I picked this poem. This is a poem by Rina Espaillat, a Latina woman. It was written in 1988, and it's called Bilingual, Bilingue. And it's written in a mixture of English and Spanish. I'm not the best pronouncer of Spanish words, so those of you who know the language better than I, forgive me. But I chose this because what we realize is that, of course, with the very limited number of boxes we've got, there are an awful lot of people who are mixes of an awful lot of things. And that position of being part of several traditions, you know, the non-white writer of Dear White Ally has a white mother, but that fact is not visible to the person sitting next to her because the skin is darker. And so there are all kinds of people in these in-betweener positions, and that's maybe going to become the new reality, that all of us are combinations of things, and that can be confusing. But it can also be a real position of power to find the ways to live out multiple identities and relations. So this is a story of a father who is still speaking Spanish only, and a daughter who is going off to learning English quickly. And in that experience of going out the door into an American public and coming back in the door to a Latino culture and language. My father liked them separate. One there, one here. Allá y aquí. As if aware that words might cut into his daughter's heart. El corazón. And lock the alien part to what he was. His memory, his name, su nombre, with a key he could not claim. English outside this door, Spanish inside, he said, y basta. But who can divide the world? The word, mundo y palabra, from any child. I knew how to be dumb and stubborn, testaruda, late, in bed, I hoarded secret syllables I read until my tongue, mi lengua, learned to run where his stumbled. And still, the heart was one. I like to think he knew that even when proud, orgulloso of his daughter's pen, he stood outside mis versos, half in fear of words he loved but wanted not to hear. I like that poem a lot. Although I did not grow up in a bilingual household, many do. Well, if you have some pen and paper, I see many of you do. Who among you does not have pen or paper? Love you. Are there those nearby who have a piece of paper to share? By chance, we have a handful of extra utensils. Yep, that's right. Oh, yep, and I've got a few of those as well. Sandra Cisneros. Ooh, just a couple of you. The House on Mango Street, this has been a very popular and award-winning book for a lot of years. It'll still be in a Borders or Amazon or something like that.
It's in a bookstore.
In the bookstore here. Excellent. Sandra Cisneros grew up in a mixed ethnic family in Chicago. And this is a series of vignettes from childhood. They're written in the voice of about an 8-year-old child. And she's thinking about her home, she's thinking about her family, and thinking about sort of coming of age. And it's written in a very lovely, brief but powerful kind of poetic language. So I'm going to read you two little excerpts and then invite you to think about your own family in light of things like the hair everyone has in your family and where your name comes from, either your last name or your first name. It won't really matter which. But this is how Cisneros sort of marks the fact that her family is of mixed heritage. Hairs. Everybody in our family has different hair. My papa's hair is like a broom, all up in the air. And me, my hair is lazy. It never obeys barrettes or bands. Carlos's hair is thick and straight. He doesn't need to comb it. Nenny's hair is slippery, slides out of your hand. And Kiki, who is the youngest, has hair like fur. But my mother's hair like little rosettes, like little candy circles, all curly and pretty because she pinned it in pin curls all day, sweet to put your nose into when she is holding you and you feel safe, is the warm smell of bread before you bake it, is the smell when she makes room for you on her side of the bed, still warm with her skin, and you sleep near her, the rain out falling outside and Papa snoring. The snoring, the rain, and Mama's hair that smells like bread. So you can be thinking a little bit about, you know, what the kinds of looks in your family and the little differences among you. And then there's a little vignette about this speaker in this story is not, it's semi-autobiographical, but the speaker is a child named Esperanza. Yeah, where did Esperanza go? Esperanza. Here we go. My name. In English, my name means hope. In Spanish, it means too many letters. It means sadness. It means waiting. It is like the number 9, a muddy color. It is the Mexican records my father plays on Sunday mornings when he is shaving. Songs like sobbing. It was my great-grandmother's name, and now it is mine. She was a horsewoman, too, born like me in the Chinese year of the horse, which is supposed to be bad luck if you're born female. But I think this is a Chinese lie, because the Chinese, like the Mexicans, don't like their women strong. My great-grandmother, I would have liked to have known her, a wild horse of a woman, so wild she wouldn't marry. Until my great-grandfather threw a sack over her head and carried her off. Just like that, as if she were a fancy chandelier. That's the way he did it. And the story goes, she never forgave him. She looked out the window her whole life, the way so many women sit their sadness on an elbow. I wonder if she made the best with what she got, or was she sorry because she couldn't be all the things she wanted to be? Esperanza. I have inherited her name, but I don't want to inherit her place by the window. At school, they say my name funny, as if the syllables were made out of tin and hurt the roof of your mouth. But in Spanish, my name is made out of a softer something, like silver, not quite as thick as my sister's name. Magdalena, which is uglier than mine. Magdalena, who at least can come home and become Nenny. But I am always Esperanza. I would like to baptize myself under a new name, a name more like the real me, the one nobody sees. Esperanza as Lissandra or Maritza or Zizi the X. Yes. Something like ZZ the X will do, says the child. So I'm just going to give you a few minutes to just go, let your mind take you where you go. Think about your name or think about the looks of the people in your family. Pick maybe a family member that you connect with or do not. And just write what comes to mind, a little brainstorming. Worry about word choice very much, or
going to write too. I'm giving up my writing papers.
Kind of exercise you can do several different times on different days, and different things will come out. Stop you in just a moment, maybe finish the sentence or the thought that you are on. Your mind will keep going, I know. If anyone would like to share what they have written with us. We're going to conclude our, we've got 10 minutes to share a few vignettes. Yes?
My mother always told me that she came from Nova Scotia, that if I ever went back there and identified myself as a Zwicker, which was her family name, I would be invited in. And I thought this was quaint. We were there on vacation, we went to a lobster feast, I meant have to mention I was a Zwicker. Immediately, I was invited to the house.
That's power. That connection. That's great. Thank you. Yes.
Hello, my name is Sinta. So I have always dealt with my Norwegian heritage every day of my life. Uh-huh. And my German mother, I remember saying to me, It took me 10 days in the hospital to learn your name, and so it has never been spoken correctly. So when you said Signa instead of Signe as a gift, it was a gift to hear it. Also, the Norwegian straight hair. My mother at my age eight said, "You can have that Norwegian hair, and it's yours for the rest of your life because I can't do a thing with it." So no gray, no curl. Won't take a permanent. So those, when you said hair and name, I thought those are the two things I've been dealing with all my life.
Interesting. Yep. Great. Thank you. Others would like to share. Yes, please.
I have 3 or 4 names in India because of being Christian, and in India we get several names. So first name is Esther. I was named after my great grandmother, and she was a praying woman, and she had knees that were calloused because she knelt so much and prayed. And later on, after I came to America, I developed a pictorial prayer book. So I thought, you know, how my parents have been kind of prophetic naming me Esther, so I will carry on the tradition of prayer in this country. And also I come from a mixture of different castes. You know, India castes are very important. My father belonged to the Brahmin caste, which is the highest, and my mother belonged to the third highest caste. They were farmers. So when I was in India, and my last name was Kantaya, everybody knew I had a Brahmin background. But then I married my husband, who belonged to the farmer caste, and we never kept family names. So one of his first names became our last name, which is Prabhakar. My husband has John, Markov, and Srinivasan Prabhakar. So those are 4 first names. And the last name became the first family name in this country. So I'm now Esther Prabhakar, which has got no history at all. So in a way, it's good. We started all over again. We started the Prabhakar dynasty here. So we are given more responsible for our name to uphold it. So these are some of the thoughts about names.
That's so interesting. Yeah, thank you. Yeah.
My name is Cohan. This is an Irish name. But everyone says Cohen when they read my name. I don't correct them largely because it's too much trouble, but also because Grandpa Cohan was Jewish. He came to this country either from Poland or Russia, depending upon whether you would have asked him or his sister. And was a Golden Gloves boxer in Chicago. The name was originally Cook, K-O-C-H. Most of the family changed their name to Cohen in Chicago, but he was a 16-year-old Golden Gloves boxer named George Meyer Cohen. And at the time, George M. Cohan was a very famous name. So his manager persuaded him to change his name to Cohan. He was George Meyer Cohan instead of George Michael Cohan. But who knew the difference?
Yeah.
So I do come by my Irishness legitimately, because then he married a woman named McCord, who was genuinely Irish, so.
That's awesome.
They're both truths.
Yeah, that's true. Right.
Yeah.
Cool.
Well, I wrote a lot about fear. My name is Shirley, and I was born in 1934. And I was named, I'm sure, after Shirley Temple. And the curls were like Shirley Temple's. Appearance was very important to my mother. Tom, my second brother, had blonde curls until he was 3-4 years old. And we were half Norwegian. We had hair that would curl. A sister who resented mom's emphasis on appearance. All 3 of us girls had curls done, ringlets done on the finger. Then my brother, 2 years younger than me, and I, the tap dancing lessons. Now, why do you think? Cleanliness was a really important thing in our household. Every Saturday, the whole house was vacuumed, and the kitchen floor cleaned, and the bathrooms cleaned, and we helped. I just want to say this. My parents stayed together. My dad worked. My mother was usually home, and neither of them were addicted to anything, and they brought us up in the church, and I feel like I had so much from those few things.
They didn't drink coffee.
Pots on at my parents' house. It's like 4-7. I don't know how they do it. Yeah. Yeah, please. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wrote down grace. Even the name conjures up positive thoughts. How lucky I was to have known her, my father's mother. She was glad that I received her husband's, my grandfather's name, since she loved him so, even though I came along 25 years after the accident that took his life. She was one of those people who no one could ever say anything bad about. And more, she was one of those people who seemed to understand me and to love me always.
Yeah.
Oh, when I was a kid, I had jet black hair.
Really?
And I was twice as dark as I am right now from the sun all summer long. And so I wrote this. When your mother is blonde and blue-eyed and you have jet black hair, the rest of the world wonders who was in the woodpile. It must have been an Indian, maybe a Chinaman, one of them. But then your father is home from his job on the road with his jet black hair hidden under his big hat. And the answer is right there when he hangs his hat inside the back door. You love it when he does that and tells you when he tosses your hair with his big hand and says, hi there. He tells you that black hair is where you came from and where blonde hair is maybe where your kids will go someday.
Often get asked about my name. I thought I might close with this sort of thought ahead about the fact that I'm Norwegian, and it's like, we? Why? How? How is that? So I hope you'll indulge that I'll use this as a way to wrap up. But maybe those of you who didn't get a chance to share with the whole group can just talk with one another a little bit more about your stories. We, a name I hated on the playground. You can all imagine why. In high school, I got all the marketing for Asian American student groups on college campuses. Even now, the occasional flyer for an international calling plan arrives in the mail, all in Vietnamese. It surprised some job interviewers that a white woman appeared in the door of the office. But the name is Norwegian, of a Germanic root. Honey Weiss beer, you might know. That Weiss with a W means white. The irony. We was perhaps the name of the farm my poor ancestor laborers worked. Their real last name was Olson. Ellis Island, late 1800s. Too many Olsons in the country. Please choose something else. And thus, the farm, my family's heritage, a building and not a land or a family tradition. Well, thanks very much.
I would never place in the
Oh, well,
a location.
Yeah. Are you related to the Lee Hall that used to be at the Morrissey that used to be at Central?
Yes.
Yeah.
I think.
When I'm around, I still go in. There's a giant photo of him in the basement hallway where they have all the passages
there.
Right.
Thanks for telling
me
your stories.
Thank you.
Yeah. Yeah, great.
Hi.
Thanks. Hi there.
I messed up a Rebecca from Northern and I seen it.
That's true. Yes.
And I was seen it had anti-racism training.
Oh.
Like Crossroads. Have you heard of Crossroads?
I have heard of them. Mm-hmm.
It's a training group.
Yeah.
They trained the different people and we went around to churches to speak, one white person and a person of color.
Oh, uh-huh.
So
very
I was
kind of
interested. I hope I didn't intrude.
Oh, no.
Yes.
No, this is not about let's all be white here.
Yes,
this is about how important it is that
the
we...
white privilege and those kind of things they talk about. So that's why I thought
it
was all right to come in.
And then I end up thinking, we can all sort of relate to these stories of sort
exactly
of where, my family name too is not, something we kind of chose and instead of having, a thread that goes way back or something.
Right,
and so we end up thinking, well, we have some things in common.
Gave me genealogy, which goes back to a slayer of dragons. Just a few breaks.
Wow, cool. That's really great.
That's neat.
The question I have is, we normally, you try to decide who is in you. You go by telling who's out. I don't know how to break that.
Well.
An awful lot of heritage has been lost in the United States.
Mm-hmm.
Really, because people became American, and they downplayed the heritage, and they lost it.
Right. Well, and this is why reclaiming, my story,
your story. You see this often.
Yeah.
The second generation comes back and says, wait, we don't want to lose it.
Yeah.
We do lose it. One generation, and it's like a language. As soon as you cease to have anybody who spoke it as a child, they lose all of the idioms.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's no longer can the language.
Yeah.
Can you go back and get the language?
Yeah.
You have to be taught it.
Yeah.
From childhood, so you know the idiom.
Yeah.
See, many Indian people that come, they just quickly change to Western clothes, so they want to fit in.
Mm-hmm.
And some reason we moved to a small town where people affirmed me and said, "Oh, you keep on wearing this sari. You look beautiful."
Oh, yeah.
So I kept it up.
Yeah.
So I think you'd be comfortable in your own skin.
What should be rich in this country is all of the cultures,
and
we stamp them out except for a few, and then
it's
not always the best part of the culture that comes.
Indeed, that's true. Well, I do think, I might be an idealist, but I do think this is how we break out of that identifying ourselves through what we're not. That's paying attention to the chaff in the field and saying, I'm not that chaff, I'm not that chaff, where I think if we do say, here's what I am, I'm part of this, I came from here, I have this privilege of skin color, but I did not have the privilege of money. I am this, I'm not that. That invites in other people's stories, because then they can say, oh, I connect with that piece, and this one's different than yours, But I think that is how you can just, little by little, get across those false and overly simplistic kind of we're the in group,
This morning at the Bible study, it was about Genesis and Hagar, Abraham's wife.
Mm-hmm.
And she pointed out a Bible verse in Genesis that I've seen so many times, if I didn't think about it. The angel asked Hagar, she's running away from Sarah, where do you come from and where are you going?
Mm-hmm.
I thought that would be much better than saying who's in, who's out.
Yeah.
Where are you coming from?
Yeah.
Where are you going?
That's wonderful.
Isn't it?
Yeah.
To the phrase.
Yeah, that is really great. Because then we can take responsibility and have some agency in where we go.
Oh,
if we decide we
want
to go somewhere where there aren't these in and outs.
So this is a pretty great story. It's
also, we have a power in the world, the United States.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that the correct action here is to renounce it. is to use it properly. It's a power
exactly.
We've been given to. We could re-step aside and all hell's going to break loose, to be quite frank.
Right.
But on the other hand, if you step heavily, people are going to get hurt.
Well, I think that dynamic actually is analogous to the one that you were raising a question about forgiving one's past.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not about, that was a person who was saying, I used to want to deny that I'm white, or I wanted to, like, push aside the white people who I thought were doing it badly, the racist white people, and say, oh, those terrible people. But then this in that poem, I think, the idea is, it's not to say, let's not be white, because we can't, if we are.
Yeah, right.
Here we are, you know. But so then the goal is to do what we have and are well and responsibly, rather than renouncing. So I think it's a similar thing with that relationship to the power of whiteness in that poem and what you're thinking about sort of economic and political power globally.
Mm-hmm.
That, you know, you can't... Renunciation is not what gets anyone very far, even though there are a lot of bad, negative things.
Right.
Like in setting up that sermon on Sunday, you know, the bishop was emphasizing, we can look around and say all kinds of things are a terrible mess, and we've all done a lot of things badly. But if we just focus on, oh, let's clean up the mess, we don't do that well. We have to just try to be our best selves.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that nationally, individually, in terms of family, that's what I hope at the moment is a way forward. So
I have the sense that humans have an instinct to what is good, and we have to just draw that out.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And
this
is the problems that we're having politically right now. That's not the way we're going.
Yeah.
But I think of a number of years ago, I was hit by a car and laid up for 6 months. Somebody said, "Well, do you give the person a throw?" And I said, it's not mine to forgive. I have no animosity to the man. I don't think he's able to run me down. But it was just instinct that it is not for me to forgive. That is not my place.
No.
That's a judgment call.
Yeah, but sometimes you forgive for your own sake.
If a person of a different personality than yours was harboring anger, and you're thinking to yourself, why should I be angry? You didn't intentionally do it. But there might be some people feeling themselves a victim, and that person might need to make a conscious decision to let go for themselves.
I'll talk about look at this. I forgot where I read it, but somewhere there, and it was a Muslim, and his Edward, he had a justice in one hand and a sword in the other. He says, the problem with Christians is that you mandate that you forgive. He says, that's not forgiveness when you have to do it. It's only forgiveness when you do it because you want to. And I have this, I think that's a valid criticism of Christianity. Some people say, you have to. No.
Well, the Bible doesn't.
To do it right, you're supposed to be compassionate.
The Bible commands love one another as yourselves. The Bible doesn't command that you... Yes, but loving one another and loving oneself may or may not include a forgiveness thing, but I think a mandate to forgive is not quite the biblical injunction.
Right.
I think that's maybe an institutional...
That's what they think about us, but
interpretation or something.
But just like we think about them as mandating that they kill off
mandating violence.
It's
not my reading of the Quran.
It's not most Quran followers' reading of
the
Quran.
I think very sad. You read the early translations of the Quran. They were done so that we could see what was terrible about the Muslims. And that's right in the preface.
You'll find
that in translation after translation. Mm-hmm. And you sit there and say, that's not going to be a very good translation. When that is what the author was trying to do.
Have you been to any of David Vesey's sessions? Well, there have only been like one or two so far, but he's philosopher, scholar.
Oh,
and
he had Holder Mavich?
Yeah, yeah. He was, I believe your husband was in his session yesterday.
Oh, about the self-interpretation.
Yes, stuff. Interpretation and hermeneutics. And yes. So, and he talked a little bit about the job of translation, because translation can never be a one-to-one thing. It's always the interpretation.
Italian say,
of
translator is the traitor.
but you might be interested in sort of his take on the fact that it's inevitable that we all interpret our lives, texts that we encounter. You know, any Bible that we read is already in translation.
Even our own childhood, when we were trying to write our own childhood memories, my sisters and brothers, we all disagreed. On certain things, you know, we live in the same household.
Absolutely. And so David's take on it is that this is why understanding the process of interpretation is necessary for everyone to sort of try to be good at. It's our responsibility to try to be good translators of the information around us, of our lives.
Right.
And it's not just the job of a theologian or just the job of the pastor in the pulpit.
Right.
You know, if we think
of
interpreting broader.
Between Islam and Christianity, one of the interesting things is, of course, they do have the original text. We don't.
Mm-hmm.
We're still trying to, but Christianity, we all read it in translation.
Yeah, yeah.
They read.
Oh,
what was
go back
by the third?
Memorize. Like confirmation.
They will memorize it even though they don't understand.
That's right. Yeah.
I find that.
I know.
We went to
one of their programs where the young kids memorized and they said it, and then they were kind of confirmed.
I had trouble memorizing anything. They do it in a foreign language, but I do not understand.
That's right.
And,
that's amazing. Yeah, the dedication.
Thank you very much.
Because they do erase more subtle differences.
Yeah, oh,
thank you guys for your contributions. Yep.
Thank you.
Thanks. Yep.
But when you I'm going to see if I can get a copy of today's
I read a few poems. I asked for a few responses to the poems.
Yeah.
We kind of talked that this issue of forgiveness came up a little bit, because one of the poems was by a white woman who was thinking about the fact that she has embarrassment for her forebears, for the racism that they perpetrated and then kind of handed down.
Mm-hmm.
And in the poem, she's saying, I forgive you for the past. You know, my job is to not deny white people. And she invokes her niece, you know, I want to love white people as much as I love my specific white niece, you know. You know, in order to move forward, I need to reclaim a connection with people and feel better about it. And a couple of people in the audience said, the poem makes me really uncomfortable. You know, the idea that it's written by a white person and forgiving white people.
Mm-hmm.
Because we still are, of course, in a racist culture and all of that. And so there's a worry, is that going to sort of not move us toward treating others better or sort of equalizing power dynamics? But then we had an interesting back and forth with no real conclusion.
You're
but
in the Bush-Christian era of how to define Christianity and how I didn't want to be part of that.
Oh.
It could be kind of taken into that.
You have to make these choices for yourself. And I think, both psychologically speaking and spiritually speaking, I think, you know, forgiving ourselves is an important step to trying to be a better person. Because otherwise you get locked down in this negativity.
Yeah.
Oh, I am not worthy. I've done bad things.
Yeah, right.
And, you know, the constant message of the gospel is, yes, we all have, you know. And I love you.
Yeah.
And so, you know, if we take seriously a gospel model, you know, we need to figure out how to love ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
And
that
is how we love our neighbors.
Mm-hmm.
So if we're thinking about diversity, this is why I wanted to start at a place like Holden, with sort of thinking about whiteness rather than just pointing to others.
Right.
You know, but it was kind of interesting. You know, the responses
right.
to...
It was really interesting. I wanted to ask you too, are you Karen and David's daughter?
I am indeed.
You are?
Yep.
You were up here when early years with your parents, right?
Yep.
I remember that. we all look different now. So.
Yeah, exactly. Well, yeah, I was here for the year in 79 when we were first here for half the year. I was 10. But then I came up a couple times with my dad's January term when I was in high school. And then I came up after college. I was a lead cook for 2 years.
Oh, you were? Oh, okay.
So 91 to 93.
Uh-huh.
And since then, I've only been back a couple times, really briefly. Yeah. So,
and I haven't seen your parents in years and years and years. Do they still
cook? They do.